the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
4 trillion plastic cigarette filters are flicked to the ground annually. 20,000 plastic bottles are sold every second. The average American produces 2 kilograms of waste every day. Just some of the stark statistics uncovered by our next guest, who also tells of an increase in gold mining in our waste. Journalist and author Oliver Franklin Wallace is the author of Wasteland, The Dirty Truth About What We Throw Away, Where It Goes and Why It Matters. Oliver, you visited a lot of places around the world as you explored the waste industry. Of all the places you went, which was the most fascinating, do you think?
Well, yeah, I kind of went all over the world following our waste, because it is a little bit like our supply chains. It is a global network, and people don't realize you put something away and it might end up thousands of miles away. But one of the things, the places that most stands out to me is standing on one of the world's largest landfills, large garbage dumps in New Delhi in India. And it's about 96 meters tall. It covers about the size of 2,000 football fields. It's like a small mountain range. And it really is there that you kind of see the scale of what we throw away every day. And particularly in parts of the world, you know, I live in England, and most of what we take away is kind of either burned or buried underground. So to see it kind of out in the open, it is kind of humbling, and also really kind of forces you to stare the problem in the face.
Just going back a little bit, the waste business has often been linked with crime or shadier operations. Why has that been?
Because it's disgusting, and so nobody wants to look at it. And there's, you know, it's funny, if you go, I don't know if anyone's watched The Sopranos, but you know, there's a reason The Sopranos all work in the waste management business. You know, it's a nice place to hide a corpse. But yeah, going back to Victorian era, and even earlier than that, waste has always kind of been entrusted to the lowest of the low, because it's something that we don't really want to touch and be seeing, and it lets you do all kind of miscreant deeds behind the scenes.
If you go back then to that sort of connection with crime in the past, and as you say, it probably spanned quite a period of time. But let's say, for example, the Mafia, the Sopranos, they're in the waste business. If you go to Italy, the real Mafia have been involved in all kinds of dodgy waste business, haven't they?
Oh, the Mafia in Italy have run the waste business for decades. And there's a place near Naples called the Triangle of Death, where there's so much toxic waste buried by the Mafia there that it's kind of toxic to everyone's health. The Mafia was caught dumping radioactive waste off the coast of Africa from Italian hospitals, for example, is a famous one. But it's all sorts. And the reality is that when you're dealing with waste, and because it's, you know, quite often it's toxic, quite often it's incredibly unpleasant to deal with. But we also don't put very much value in it, right? We sell it to the lowest, you know, it goes to the lowest bidder. And so in order to kind of keep people's costs down, we've been willing to look away. And that means that people who have been abusing our environmental laws and things have been getting away with it. And you see these stories all over the world, whether it's here in the UK or, you know, I was in Ghana in Africa, which is where we send a lot of our secondhand clothing, and seeing the fast fashion piling up on landfills or coating beaches. Like, as far as I can see, all you see is secondhand clothing that's been shipped there and dumped.
What does that say about the circular economy and the response to fast fashion? Would you have your doubts about how that's playing out?
I'm very skeptical about how much fast fashion brands actually want to disrupt their own business model. I think that there's various versions of the circular economy, but there's a real risk we get into this version of the circular economy, which is making even cheaper things that we recycle really quickly, and it just makes us kind of move through that cycle faster and faster. You imagine, you know, a guinea pig in its little wheel. So most people don't really understand that when you give something to a charity shop, only between about 10 and 30% of those clothes are resold in store. The majority of them are sent off and they're sorted and graded and essentially sold to the global south, right? And they end up in places like Ghana. And I would go to these big sorting facilities, and you would see the stuff that people were donating, and it's ripped and it's stained and there's baby sick on it, and kind of it's just in a condition that you would feel ashamed to try and sell that to someone, right? We treat the donations bin as another form of the bin. So first of all, we need to kind of crack down on that and only donate things that you would actually be proud to wear yourself. And the second thing is to really crack down on the companies, these middlemen, these companies who are knowingly sending trash to countries that have no waste management systems. You know, that Ghana had one like modern landfill that was paid for with a loan but from the World Bank, and it filled up. It was meant to last 30 years, and it filled up in fast with fast fashion clothing in 3. And then because all of those clothing are quite often made from plastic, it caught fire and it burned to the ground. And the head of the waste management department of Accra, the capital of Ghana, cried as he described to me the fact that people in Ghana, who let's be honest, it's like some of the poorest people in the world, are still paying interest on a World Bank loan for a landfill that they can't use because our fashion, you know, our fast fashion helped it burn to the ground. And that's just an injustice.
The waste industry around the world can be, and you talk about this in the book, it can be dangerous.
Actually, the statistics show that working in waste is, I think, even more dangerous than being a police officer, statistically, because of the heavy machinery that goes on. But also, if you work in the global south, somewhere like India, in India, they don't really have formalized garbage collection. In lots of cities, they have what are called waste pickers. They're kind of a lesser social class, or they're treated as lesser social class. And it's people who go around picking through your waste for recyclables, and that their livelihood is selling recyclables, plastics and metals to scrap dealers, essentially. And, you know, in India, I write about Ghazapur, this landfill I was talking about earlier. And recently it set on fire. There was some horrendous images coming out of India of this massive landfill, because they're essentially, you know, fuel, these gigantic mountains of fuel, and they quite regularly catch fire, for example. And in India, the community, there are communities of waste pickers who live around the dump, and their houses burn down. And so that's just kind of one piece of this, but it's tremendously dangerous work as well as being tremendously unpleasant.
2018 was a significant year for you in relation to the whole global waste industry. Why was that? What happened?
So in 2018, China, which for the previous two decades had been kind of the predominant destination for a lot of the world's recycling, finally got sick of being the world's garbage can, and they shut its doors, and they passed a suite of legislations called National Sword, and essentially said, like, we don't want any of your stuff anymore, we're kind of sick of it, we've got our own waste to deal with. And it sent the kind of global waste industry into a tailspin. They had nowhere to send anything, and waste started turning up in countries like Indonesia and Malaysia and Thailand. And kind of one by one, these countries started being flooded with garbage. And you people might remember seeing footage of their supermarket like bags turning up in fields in Malaysia, like dumped in the middle of nowhere in ditches. And so we're kind of still living with the reckoning of that here today.
And a lot has changed as well. For example, this idea of urban mining and trying to extract valuable items from waste, that's a growing phenomenon. What's involved in that?
Yeah, so urban mining is and landfill mining is a growing trend, because there's real value in what we throw away. If you think about something like an aluminium can, for example, recycling one of those is about 95% lower carbon emissions, but also, you know, it's valuable material, right? Buying virgin aluminium, digging out the ground, is expensive. You think about electronics. Electronics are our fastest growing source of waste. Your headphones, your AirPods, your old phones, your old laptops and TVs. There are rare earth metals in there. There's gold. There's copper. There's all these things that recycling that waste companies really value, right? And for a long time, we kind of didn't really pay enough attention to it, so our recycling rate was very low. So there is this phenomenon of companies now, mining companies actually, like Glencore, going back and looking at old landfills and thinking about, well, can we drill down in there? Because if you look at waste, there's actually more copper per weight in a ton of recycling waste than there is in a ton of copper ore. So it makes sense for them to go back and be looking at these things as resources, you know, as places where there's value to be found.
You also deal with really toxic waste, like nuclear waste and Sellafield, which is something that people in Ireland are very aware of, because there were all kinds of campaigns and everything and concerns about it, not talked about so much. How big a problem is that kind of toxic waste?
I stood in the vaults at Sellafield on the high-level nuclear waste. That's the kind of really noxious stuff after nuclear waste reprocessing. So a lot of the radioactivity is dealt with in the waste processing. But at the end, you end with this kind of really concentrated liquor of nasties that will be radioactive in some form for about 10,000 years. Certainly for the first few hundred, it's very radioactive indeed. And you stand on these vaults that are several meters thick, reinforced with steel and all of these materials to kind of hide them away, and you can still feel the heat coming off them. I don't think we are, you know, the nuclear age is less than 100 years old. And I don't think we're really equipped yet to know what to do with that stuff. There's still debate in the UK about where are we going to put it in the long term? Are we going to dig one of these deep geological vaults?
Real innovations, Oliver, then, are there ones that you think are effective?
Oh, that, I mean, that's the kind of most exciting part, really, is that this kind of crisis and showing what's been going wrong over the last couple of decades, we've really woken up as a society to the reality of our waste, whether that's, you know, the secondhand market and apps like Depop and things where people are kind of recirculating things and making them last longer, whether that's the return of repair and repair culture. That the best jacket you own is not the one that you're going to buy from the environmental conscious company. It's the one that you already own, right? So it really is about buying things that you love and taking joy, finding joy and finding meaning and looking after it, and then we'll all be better off.
At its core, if you want people to buy fewer things around the world, that means we manufacture fewer things, which means that millions of people lose their jobs who work in manufacturing, which has a financial economic consequence in terms of wealth creation. And even if that's the right thing to do and that's the direction we need to go, it's not a very good political election manifesto, is it? You know, I want you all to buy less. Some of you will lose your jobs, but it will be better for us all in the long run. It's a hard sell, isn't it?
I don't think that's true at all. I think that's the totally wrong-headed characterization of what's actually happening. Because what you're describing has already happened. Like, the jobs have already gone, and the jobs are already becoming more and more mechanized. So this idea that buying less is going to somehow damage depress economic growth is just untrue. There is no reason that you can't find a middle ground and that you can't find economic models that make things last longer. I'll give you an example. I have two small children. I started renting their bikes, right? And so I pay a company rather than buying a bike and then having to chuck it away or find someone to buy it at the end. We rent it. At the end, you send it back, you upgrade it for another one. And I pay a subscription fee to that company. That company is doing pretty well. Like, I think that's an interesting model that hasn't existed before. So it's really about finding new solutions rather than this kind of doom and gloomerism of like, okay, well, if we don't do it exactly the way that we currently do it, bad things are going to happen. Like, look around. The bad things are already happening. We need to find solutions that come at these problems with a proactive and like optimistic mindset. And so I'm really excited to see what's going on in the space. And I hope that other people feel the optimism that I do.
Well, on that optimistic note, Oliver Franklin Wallace, author of Wasteland, The Dirty Truth About What We Throw Away, Where It Goes and Why It Matters. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.